On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Sean McGeever about his brand new book on slavery. So we cover all sorts of topics like, should we still even care about slavery? Does that matter? Should we distinguish between condemning how slavery works versus the institution of slavery? Should we reject the entire institution? Why do these figures like Edwards and Whitfield and Wesley, why are they so important for this conversation? What sort of theological influences are Whitfield and Edwards having that leads them to their particular view of slavery? What are potentially some similarities or differences between these figures and how they understand the institution of slavery? How did the Quakers influence the anti-slavery movement during this time? And how did their theology impact their opposition to slavery? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. We think that the intellectual culture that we're trying to encourage and cultivate are things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And so when we say those sort of things, what we really mean to say is that we think that you should be a careful thinker, rigorous in your argumentation, and to not hold back in that element, but also to be kind and careful, or I guess careful is an appropriate word, but kind and generous to other people and their viewpoints, and realize that sometimes we don't have it all figured out, and that we can learn something from everybody. And that means everybody we talk to. So we have all sorts of people on the podcast all across the spectrum. It's a lot of fun. We get to make friends with people that you didn't know you could become friends with, and suddenly you become friends because you find these things that you just connect over, and it's really cool. So we enjoy bringing you all along for the ride. If this is your first time, hang on. It's going to be a lot of fun. Today we have Dr. Sean McGeever with us, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Ownership: The Evangelical Legacy of Slavery in Edwards, Wesley, and Whitfield. And I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be a lot of fun, partly just because Sean's great. I really enjoy him, respect him, and I think he's just a model sort of Christian and thinker, but also because the book is interesting, and then thirdly, because the book is just beautiful. So any book that has a wonderful cover is going to catch people's eye. So definitely check it out. I'm going to put the link in the description or the show notes, wherever you're listening, whatever you call it, and you can click the link and go there. And I mean, any book that has both Mark Knoll and George Marsden on it, if you're a regular listener, you know both of them, will tell you that it's worth your time. So Sean, before we jump into the book itself, maybe remind our listeners, you've been on before, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then what was it that really got you interested to say, I've got to write this book?
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Jordan. I'm really honored to be here and be here again. I'm a frequent listener, including this morning on my run. So I appreciate all that you and the team do. Sean McGeever, I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona, one of the few natives heading into the summer here. So we're all trying to leave as much as possible. Here's the backstory for me. I didn't grow up going to church in high school, actually a Young Life leader. Met me on campus, introduced me to the gospel. I came to Christ and changed my life, trajectory of everything in my life. Served in the church and Young Life, things like that since then. So one of the things that I started to do after a bit of that was recognize that the gospel that I encountered through God's grace was a certain kind of gospel that definitely effective and true. I'm super happy to kind of keep passing along the gospel that I was received, but I also noticed that it was an evangelical gospel, and I didn't really know what that was. I went to seminary, enjoyed that, learned a little bit more about it, but then I went and got another degree at St. Andrews MLit, and I studied how the gospel is communicated in the early church, wrote my dissertation there, went on to Aberdeen to write my PhD on how evangelicals think about conversion. So when I got there, I started studying John Wesley, George Whitfield. He wasn't the third person in my book. Jonathan Edwards wasn't the focus of my thesis, but he was just another dialogue partner I couldn't talk about all of them effectively in a thesis. So all of this is a bit of a larger project to be in awe and wonder of the gospel message I received and that I'm excited to continue to pass on. I'm, you know, an evangelist, I'm a minister here for a long time. So it's a bit of my own curiosity about the gospel and also the type of gospel and the people that pass the gospel, the kind of the heritage and lineage I received. And so that led me to be a student of Wesley Whitfield and now Edwards. That was my PhD. And then I've done some various things related to books and things related to evangelism. But I had these lingering questions about their historical backgrounds of these three men that I footnoted in my thesis and then came out with my book of Lexham, Born Again. But I didn't, in the kind of, you know, PhD work, you don't have time to look into all the things you'd like to look into. So finally the time came and I was like, I want to look into this. I don't think it's been documented the way that that I was able to access it. I'd like someone to write a book like this. And so that's what I did, which is I sat down as a scholar of Wesley and Whitfield and Edwards to write kind of the history of this and figure out what I could learn about it. And I found out a bunch of things, not only some of the history that your listeners, some of your listeners will be well aware of, you know, I can go back through that if you want, but also a couple other layers of information that I was surprised by what I found and I find instructive, not only for ministry and pastoral ministry and that sort of thing, but also a bit of ways to assess the theology that I've received in helpful ways, and also about what we do with our heroes that fail and some of the theology and kind of pastoral approaches that we might have for all those.
So you mentioned there at the end, some of the sort of like pastoral applications. And I do think that that was a really nice touch and unique aspect to it. And it's really shot through, it seems like, through the book, but especially at the end, we're giving those sort of like assess your own legacy. And I just found that it's really unique in sort of scholarship today, honestly. There's just a lot of scholarship doesn't really want to consider that for whatever reason. Maybe it's just like, you know, that's too introspective or colloquial. So maybe talk a little bit about, I mean, why you feel like it's necessary to have that sort of section in a book like this and what the reception has been so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like many books, mine has an introduction saying why am I writing this book, and it has a conclusion. In the middle is a lot of history, and the history's there, and it's footnoted. I did my best to footnote it, and I'm very fortunate, like you mentioned, for Mark Knoll, George Marsden, Ken Minkema, Randy Maddox, the people who, in my mind, are the people that need to sign off in all the fields of Wesley Whitfield and Edwards to say, yeah, this is on track. And so they're very kind, in fact, more than I thought, with their words about my book. So I feel like the core of the book is the history. So anyone who loves history, curious about history, wants to know the background to those people, and a couple of things that might not have been highlighted quite as bit in other books, will really like the core of that book. Some of the theology, why is it that they arrived at what they arrived? So it's not just history, it's a historical theology, and there's that. But to your question about like the last chapter, I mean, I just couldn't, being the type of person I am, the types of things I do, I couldn't just leave it with just history. And I did talk to my friend, Thomas Kidd. He's been kind and helped me in a lot of different ways and different projects. And I remember last ETS, we went to dinner and I was like, okay, Tommy, like, hey, you know, I want to do this serious history work, but I just feel like I need to add this last chapter to try to bring it down to why does it matter? And he's like, you should definitely do that. So when Tommy said you should do that, I really felt, and all, it's all my responsibility, what I wrote. I'm not trying to throw him under the bus. I need to do this for myself and for others. And that was the hardest part to write. I have a couple versions of it. I replaced every single word that I wrote a few times. But yeah, I needed to figure out why it mattered. And so the structure of the whole book is, it starts with kind of the situation that we're born into. And then when we participate in things, and then we might be active in growing against or choosing different paths with what we have. And then there's our legacy. So anyway, there's four sections of the book. And the last chapter is, like you said, kind of an assessment to say, okay, let's do this with ourselves. We just did this with these three figures. We learned a lot. Let's turn the same methodology on ourselves. What situation were you born into? You had no choice where you're born. you know, what area you're born, Christian, non-Christian, whatever. So that, but at a certain point, and this is part two, you decided to participate. It's almost like an age of accountability. At some point, you kind of looked around and knew what you were doing and need to be held accountable. You can't say, this is just where I was born. This is what I was taught. You're accountable, so you participate in it. The third part about being active, some of us recognize, you know, I think I want to change direction on something. Maybe it's small, maybe it's large. And all of us, I think they're honest, say, you know, I don't think exactly the same way that I did about something 20 years ago. There's probably, whether it's smaller, you know, big or small, there's a couple things that the 20 years ago version of myself, little different. And to be realistic, to say, you know, Lord willing, if there's another 20 years, is there a chance that I could move on from a couple positions I'm in, whether they be small or large, who knows? And yeah, so I think it's just a very realistic position. And that's what I did with these men and how they may or may not have changed. But to think about that for ourselves. So I have some questions for self-reflection on that. And then the last one is like about our legacy, which is what I did for them. I walked through their legacies and the trajectory of their lives. That's the benefit of studying people who've been dead for a couple hundred years. And say, you know, what kind of legacy do you think you're going to leave? And by God's grace, we all know that we're going to have a checkered past. That's just a being honest about it. But if I'm aware of things, maybe I have an intuition or an instinct, you know, we can make some decisions and think about what we're leaving to the people that we are around currently or those that might come after us. So yeah, it was a bit of that. And then also unpacking one other layer, which was, you know, I received this evangelical gospel, of which I still retain the title evangelical loosely. I pretty closely to the early evangelicals, modern evangelicals, different story. However, are there lessons learned that are pregnant in the evangelical history of early evangelicalism that have continued today? And I have a couple words about evangelicals and some things that we can notice from that era that are still in motion today.
Yeah. And I know I'm totally going out of order with this, but that's part of what I find fun about these interviews is I try to keep them organic some degree. And so in that ending chapter there on owning white American evangelical Christian history, you have a couple of sort of examples there. And two of them that I found really interesting. Number one is the concept of power and sort of like the celebrity Christianity that's there. I'd love for you to sort of unpack the abuses of power that happen in evangelicalism and how that sort of relates to the overall topic. But also on the flip side, you had the biblicism section, which it doesn't like click with me, but for some reason, as you are articulating it there, it clicked of like, oh, this is an actual real life scenario of biblicism causing lots of interpretive damage. Because oftentimes, I mean, today biblicism seems to be very much like you use that in, it's really popular in Doctrine of God discussions and some other things right now. Whereas I don't feel like a lot of other people are kind of like showing the abuses of what happens when you're a biblicist. But here, this seems to click for me. So I'd love for you to unpack both of those if you would.
Right. Yeah, that's good. So one of the aspects about early evangelicalism is it is occurring during a time where the print media is starting to rise. One of the things that George Wesley is well known for is being the first transatlantic celebrity. He was a master of promotion. He was a master of a great friendship with Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, I mean, you can read from, Thomas Kidd's writings on him. It was a symbiotic relationship in which Benjamin Franklin remained to be a deist. However, he recognized that this friendship with Whitfield was fascinating. He was curious about how loud Whitfield could be, but he also realized it would sell. So they had a very interesting lifelong relationship. So essentially, the media outlets of the day were fascinated with Whitfield. It was a win-win for them and for Whitfield. So he liked them. They liked him. That was great. So just a wild number of people would show up, particularly to Whitfield. He kicked off this outdoor preaching, field preaching, of which Wesley then started doing, which was the rise of the Methodist societies, which ended up being the largest Christian denomination in the 1800s. So it's of the formative years of early America, it's Methodism. outdoor preaching, revivals, great awakening. The thing that comes with all that is a great temptation to think it depends upon me. I mean, it's who's on the microphone. It's who's in the print. It's whose sermons are you going to show up to when the revival? It's where are we pointed? And we're not just talking about a small congregation, of which a lot of congregations even today and back then were small. But if you get 100, 500, 1,000, and those times, sometimes 10, 20, 30,000 people all pointed at one person, George Whitfield was often the focal point. That's just a wild amount of power. Meanwhile, there's also a greater sensitivity to the work of the Spirit. That's one of the things that is happening in the Great Awakening. It's kind of wild that both in Edwards, which is a bit shocking, that there's these, you know, he's a student of, and we see this progression of him trying to analyze genuine works of the Spirit. However, people are emotional when they're hearing this gospel in a way that didn't seem like were happening in the past. That's happening in New England. That's happening in England. That's happening in the South. It's happening all over. So you have people having highly emotional responses to in large groups to someone up front that's been promoted. There's been like an anticipation through media, through word of mouth, and all that. That is part of the evangelical ethos, and there's just no way around it. That is a formula for power, because when I deliver that message, there's incredible power that hinges on my words, my appearance, my showing up or not showing up. All of that. And so that's just a part of early evangelicalism that we see today leveraged in sometimes in some great ways and sometimes in very tragic and bad ways. Yeah. So with that, I mean, I would add on to that. One of the other, there's four things that I highlight about the kind of continued issues with evangelicalism, of which, you know, like I said, I still feel like I am a part of. But with that power, the topic of evangelism, of which I am an evangelist, there's an incredible amount of emotional pressure and pride that can go into your head if you believe, and it's God's word, and I can come back onto this, that if I say this or I don't say this, people's eternal destiny will be determined on what I say. And so in evangelism, there can be a great temptation to think that I am the effective means of someone being saved. Now, like I wrote a book with Lexham. I was asked to write a book on Lexham for the evangelism for the cure of souls. And that book is basically a huge focus is on the emotional roller coaster of what it's like to be an evangelist. It's not a how-to. There's a little bit of this and that, but there's other books for nuts and bolts of evangelism. But this like power dynamic that especially happens in evangelism where when we preach that you can be born again, and if people do or don't, the power that has over your audience and the power that it ends up having on you is in just a wild, complicated, tempting, and beautiful at times situation that we just need to be especially kind of hyper aware of for those that are in that space. Yeah. I can come back to biblicism too, but yeah, just maybe pause for a second.
One of the questions I did want to lead with, and I want to make sure to spend some time on, is just so the overall topic, you know, slavery, especially in Edwards and some others. Why should we still care about that? Because I'm just imagining a decent segment of listeners saying, like, "Hey, you know, we've talked about this enough already. We know Edwards is a slave owner. We know, right. We know Whitfield. We know these things. We know they're bad. Okay, like let's move on now." You know, we've all done the Calvin and Servetus, you know, bad.
Yeah.
Like, should we still care about this today?
Yeah. A couple reasons. One is if there are people that don't know, we don't want people to be caught in the dark. So if you are aware or even a fan of any of these three people, of which I am, I appreciate immensely the contributions that they've made to Christendom, but we also need to not be caught in the dark. So, you know, many of your listeners will be aware of their failures, and I can rehearse those if needed, but we don't want to be caught in the dark. The second thing would be that there are advocates or people who still promote slavery. It's kind of wild, but there are some pro-slavery, institution of slavery Christians out there, some that have prominent voices. There are other versions as well, maybe not so obvious, of modern slavery, like trafficking, forced labor, even prison labor. But maybe two things that might be relevant for folks that are already aware of this, but I can come back to either of those other points. The first point of two would be that this is a fascinating study of 100 years or a century when Christians changed their opinion on something that they had been set on for 1700 years. Like, you know, if you're like, oh, I wonder if the church could ever change on this topic, that topic, whether that's a good thing or bad thing, I'm not saying, but this is a study when the church just really pivoted, started to pivot. Prior to 1700, there really were no Christians in power that were against the institution of slavery. 100 years later, at 1800, there are Christians in power who are against the institution of slavery for the first time. So it provides a really interesting study how the church at large could make a massive turn. And then the other thing I'd add is that there's a interesting dynamic for biblical interpretation and consistent hermeneutics, which is a quite complicated discussion. However, we should be prepared for anyone who searches for kind of criticisms of Christianity, or someone who's unpacking things or whatever it is, this is going to be a question, and you need to be prepared for an informed answer about how to interpret the Bible on these topics, of which my book doesn't really attend to specifically. I can talk to a bit here. But yeah, those are like a couple of reasons why we'd want to be interested in this topic right now, even though for some of us, it's already worn us out.
Yeah. So you say, like, for 1700 years, church has sort of like a position on this. And I think that it makes me uncomfortable to think that, like, you know, there's something that could be believed for this long and then you change your mind on it. Because it seems like you wouldn't want to say that something that has been universally agreed on for that long, mm-hmm. Has been a mistake. Though I guess, you know, I'm a Baptist, so a lot of people want to come and say, well, you guys just your credo baptism just suddenly pops up. Though I would dispute that fact. you can't dispute it totally, but you know, there's stuff. But I guess in a sense I get it. But there is a level of, like, when you say for 1700 years they are pro institution of slavery, is it sort of like a flippant pro institution of slavery, not really thinking about it? It's just kind of like, that's just part of what the culture does. Mm-hmm. And only at some point here at this period do we start to really think about the topic itself, and that is what causes us to rethink what's been going on for however long.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you highlighted this, because one of the things I worked really hard at, I recognized that the literature wasn't as clear on this topic, and I'd really want everyone to be able to think about it this way, about the topic of slavery this way. And this is really, really important. There's a massive difference between the management of slavery and the institution of slavery. For some reason, people miss that. And I, in my blind peer review and things like that, that this book had, they said, you highlighted that really well. People have not done that. So here's what I'd say about the first 1700 years of slavery, Christians in slavery. What you find there is there are quite a few Christians who are very concerned about the Christianly management of the institution. So, like, make that really clear. Let's be the best version of biblical slave owners that we can be. So there are quite a few people who are concerned about that, including Edwards, including Whitfield, including a host of people. What they're missing for that 1700 years is not about the management of slavery, but is it possible, and this is what you get in around, you know, the year 1800, a little bit before that too, but is it possible that actually the entire institution should be rejected for looking at the Bible in its whole entirety and what it's communicating, which is a difficult question, but that's really important, and people miss that. So, right, for the first 1700 years, you see them concerned with, like, the Christianly ethical management, as if you can even say that, of the institution, versus let's just get rid of the whole thing, which happens later.
Yeah. No, and that you do bring out that distinction really, really well. And I think it's valuable, and that I want to press in a little bit more, because I can admit, I mean, even growing up, that was probably a distinction that wasn't, like, connected to my mind. Like, when mm-hmm. I talk to people about the evils of slavery, it's about, well, they didn't do it properly. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to, you know, the ancient period, the reason Paul doesn't condemn it explicitly is because, well, it's a different type of slavery.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned John MacArthur in there, and I think John has said something along those lines where, like, if you have, like, an ideal sort of social arrangement, that is what, like, that's a good thing. And I think even today on some of the return to some of the older political theories where there's an impulse to want to go back and say that this is a proper social arrangement. And yet you want to say the entire institution is rotten through and through. And I know your book isn't like a theological account of trying to you know, determine and to decide this sort of stuff. But I would be interested in hearing your take on that and to say, like, why is it that the institution itself is problematic and we should just reject it in full?
Right. I have my book in front of me. The quote that maybe some of your, you know, listeners have heard from MacArthur is, he writes this, the quote, "It's strange that we have an aversion to slavery because historically there's been abuses for many people, poor people, perhaps people who weren't educated, perhaps people who had no other opportunity. Working for a gentle, caring, loving master was the best of all possible worlds. Slavery is not objectable if you have the right master. It's the perfect scenario," end quote. He then goes on to say, "Neither the Old nor New Testament condemns slavery as such. Social strata are recognized and even designed for by God for man's good." He celebrates that, quote, "The back of the black slave trade was broken in Europe and America due largely to the powerful spirit-led preaching of such men as John Wesley and George Whitefield," end quote. Anyway, first off, he's completely wrong about George Whitefield. He doesn't know what he's talking about there, all due respect. He's right about a bunch of stuff. On this one, he's 100% wrong about George Whitefield. The Wesley one's a little more complicated. You can read my book to hear about it. But there's just a clear recognition there that he's concerned with the biblical management of slavery, not the institution. And Doug Wilson does the same type of move. He says, oh, you know, slavery in the American South, that's not what was going on in the New Testament era. And he's just flat out wrong. I mean, absolutely wrong about the institution and the ethic of it. Your question is about how does the Bible, or how should Christians think about rejecting the institution?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And the trick about that is you can read, and I'll give it a short answer at the end here, but you have smart listeners, so I want to give them the full, at least part of the full story. You need to go back and recognize, you don't need to read the whole thing, but you need to read or be aware that books like Mark Knoll's The Civil War is a Theological Crisis, which is why is it that Americans have the Civil War, and that this exact topic, there was good, honest Christians, brothers and sisters in Christ, saints that we will know, who were absolutely divided about the way that the Bible is read on this. And these are our brothers and sisters of Christ, who are sinners just like you and I are, but also have received the grace of Jesus. They read the Bible honestly and just were completely divided on it. Noel then followed up another book, America's Book, which I reviewed for Christianity Today. And I talked to Mark about this, and he just kind of continues this. He has a couple more layers he adds, but basically he says that the pro-slavery view is based upon a straightforward reading of the Bible, and appealed to people who, and this is not a comment on their capacities or whatever, were more comfortable with a straightforward answer, while the anti-slavery or abolitionist reading took nuance. It took a bit of an understanding of how hermeneutics work. It took an understanding about genre and different, how you might read differently, and understanding a larger meta-narrative about the whether or not you want to use the word trajectory. That's a little bit William Webb and stuff like that, a little bit more controversial, but you need to look. It's just a longer conversation overall. So Mark Knoll has put his finger on how complicated this is, and he's done that really well. I would suggest those books to your readers if they want to investigate that. Here's the shorter answer, which is Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, is captured in the air of a culture in which that we have to step back and understand the norms that were there, even if they were wrong. I was on a radio interview earlier today, and the host went on for a while about polygamy, which is a whole nother topic. I'm not here to talk about that. But understanding that culture is the air that we breathe, and our Bible, that God has authored through humans, through men, is written with that. And we have to recognize that. Meanwhile, we also would recognize that the ethical trajectory of Jesus, and whom the culmination of all this is to do as to others as we do unto us. None of us should want to seek to be a slave. We can be, and this is where we got to understand a whole bunch of words. We can be a slave to Christ. Why? Because God created us. The ontological difference between God and humans is there's a proper relationship where we are slaves to Christ because God owns us because he made us. That is proper to the creator-creation distinction. When we come to those passages where we're slaves to Christ, we should embrace that as the creator-creation distinction. The creation-to-creation relationship is not proper for us to be master-slave to one another. We are peers with every other human, and we should only be a slave to Christ, not to another person. And there is an obvious recognition from the beginning to end that it's not good to be a slave. I mean, why is it that Egypt should get out? It's bad that they are enslaved. They should seek to get out of that. Paul repeats that people should, if they have ability, get out of this. It's never spoken of in a positive light. So if Christ's ethic is for us to do unto others as we would want done to us, I don't want to be a slave. The Bible provides a rationale that I shouldn't want this. This isn't proper for myself. I should seek to get out of this if I have an opportunity. Why in the world would I do this to another person? There's a couple other layers to it, but that's the strongest argument, how we could read the kind of overall ethic, especially when it reaches its pinnacle in Jesus, to be able to reject slavery.
Yeah, that's good. So you picked Edwards, Wesley, and Whitfield. In your mind, who else would you really like to include if you were to write a larger book? Who are the other figures that say they really need to have their story told too?
Wow, that's, no one's asked me that question, Jordan. That's really, you're good. Okay. Well, first off, there is a person that's in there that's a Quaker, Anthony Benize. He has almost an entire chapter. So that's fascinating. Why is it that the Quakers, who were definitely a fringe group, no one was going to them for theology advice, like Orthodox Christians. Wesley and Whitfield were trying to convert the Quakers. Edwards spoke really bad about the Quakers. Everyone's dunking on the Quakers. And yet these Quakers have it. Wesley decides to listen to them, at least on this topic. And he eventually goes, you know what? They have a point. And to their credit, Anthony Benize, in the document that really kind of was the catalyst for Wesley to speak up, Anthony Benize provides biblical rationale. He includes someone's sermon in there, of which Wesley then strips all of that and gets rid of the Bible stuff that Benize has, gets rid of the sermon and the kind of Christian exhortation. And Wesley makes explicit in his 1774 Thoughts Upon Slavery, he says, I'm going to base my rationale on natural law, which some of your readers would probably find fascinating. In that specific era, 1774, right there, if you kind of know a little bit what's going on, philosophy, liberty, law, all sorts of interesting things are happening right there on government and on natural law. Anyway, beside the point there, who else would I include? Well, I do have a bit about some Quakers, so that would be one person. I also have just a little bit on the legacy. So if you look at, Whitfield really didn't have any inheritors of his legacy. The two other streams would be the Methodist legacy. So I have just a little bit on American Methodism, which is a really complicated case because Wesley doesn't really provide the biblical rationale. He does not provide the biblical rationale for them to have a strong well to go back to be able to stand up against the slavery in the American colonies and early America. So like a deeper dive on early Methodism, as well as a deeper dive on Samuel Hopkins and on Jonathan Edwards Jr. One of the things that was fascinating for me is Jonathan Edwards Jr. Grows up in Stockbridge. He knows Mohican, and all of his friends are speaking Mohican. The only place he's speaking English is pretty much when he goes home, which is not the majority of the day. My instinct was that the reason that Jonathan Edwards Jr., sometimes called the younger, becomes an abolitionist was probably because of his upbringing, maybe being aware of the equality of people, et cetera, just being aware and around a diverse group of people. As it turns out, that assumption was wrong. There was a overlooked journal article that came out just a couple of years ago that no one had really noticed. And I read it carefully. I showed it to some other Edwards experts. They said, wow, look at that. That is something. At first, Edwards Jr. was pro-slavery. And there's a couple sermons that a couple that people have not looked up, but they're there. And he's pro-slavery. He gives these arguments for slavery, which is kind of what it makes sense. His dad had been pro-slavery. Samuel Hopkins was pro-slavery. Bellamy was pro-slavery. All these folks are pro-slavery. But then when Hopkins publishes, brings to light Jonathan Edwards' True Virtue, like things really like come together. So it's actually Jonathan Edwards, you know, ideas in Nature of True Virtue that bring Hopkins to, it's not explicit, but the timing is lines up pretty good that when that comes to light, Hopkins changes his mind. Edwards Jr. At first, actually, we don't know that he doesn't make it explicit. He writes anonymous letters to the newspaper, a series of them, that like 20 years later, he publishes as his own, he gives as his own sermon. So we know in retrospect that they were him. And so there's this really fast, it'd probably be the Edwardians that I would want to write a bit more about how they did some of that. And John Lowe is a scholar who's done a lot of good work on that and a couple other people. But yeah, those would be some people I'd want to talk more about is kind of how this was received. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of things I want to follow up on. So between the three figures, it seems to me that Whitfield, like, it makes more sense that he would be pro-slavery just given his own ministry context. And it seems like he probably, like, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but like, it just seems like what all he's trying to accomplish, I feel like his need for relationships like that is greater. Mm. Then someone like, and then when Edwards, you know, he leaves Northampton and he's among the Indians, it seems like that would be a prime time for him to rethink his relationship to slavery. Hmm. Why doesn't he do that in large measure, do you think?
Hmm. Yeah. So for people who were born in England, I think that this narrative is pretty true. They were comfortable with the master-servant dynamic because of the classism that is very embedded in England. So when they come to Bible passages that say, you know, master, servant, it's doulos in Greek, so it's slave for sure, which is a different topic. But I think that they understand that a servant is someone you hire that has freedom. They can choose to leave. I think they're much more comfortable with this dynamic. Wesley grew up in a house with servants, people who were hired and could leave. Whitfield also did. When Whitfield comes to America, and the transatlantic slave trade had evolved, that the Christians who'd come over from England translated the master-servant dynamic that they were used to into the master-slave. Now, the biblical word is definitely slave. I just want to make that really clear. But there's this cultural nuance about the relationship, which they then apply. Richard Baxter actually has a section in his Christian Directory. He's the first one to do it. It's about 1680 when he does that, which coincides exactly when the rise of the transatlantic slave trade just went up significantly. And he has guidance in, I could get into it later about what the Puritans did with their household order. But Whitfield comes over and I think he encounters this kind of application of the master-servant dynamic. He founds an orphanage in Georgia. He can't fund it. At first, Georgia is it was the only colony that did not allow slavery. It sounds like a really noble thing. It actually was to create a buffer state between Spanish Florida and the Carolinas so that if there was a black person who was found in Georgia fleeing to Spanish Florida because they would be emancipated, because they would be expected if they'd fled and that they're emancipated upon coming into Florida, that then they would fight against their masters, go back to colonial America. So Georgia is... yes, a colony that was developed without slavery, but only as a safety guide, not out of any ethical reasons, which is just wild. My book highlights that. But when he gets there, Whitfield says, I really can't make the finances work for my orphanage unless slavery is legal. So he and others go to Parliament and actually have the laws changed. And he makes it legal to, and there's more to the story that's in my book, but he and others make it legal to be able to enslave people to fund his orphanage. So at the end of his life, he is enslaving 49, well, there's 50 at first, and then 49 when they have the inventory of his estate, that helping 16 orphans be able to live there. But with that, I think that Whitfield adopts the kind of biblical reading that he had from all of his influences, which I talk about in the book, and he has it. Edwards, on the other hand, when he does go to Stockbridge, this is where we have his one writing on slavery, which was a draft letter, which was Ken Minkema found it. It's on the back. It's classic Edwards, on the back of scraps of paper that he made into other sermons. So I had to get pieced together through the wizardry of great archivists and Ken Minkema doing all that. But it is a pro-slavery document, it's on a very different topic, about another minister who had like three jobs going, and his congregants were saying, man, he has too much money, and he's enslaving people. And so they want Edwards to comment on him, and that's why we have this little bit on him. But Edwards, in that, he does approve of it, and that's why, that's the only, we know his practice. But yeah, he comments on it. He does at that point change one thing, which he is clarifies that he's against the unjust acquisition of enslaved people, which seems to be a change of mind, since earlier in his life he had not done that. But golly, I just started telling a whole bunch of stories about these people. Your question was, why is it that Whitfield was more prone to that? I think it has to do, it's really simple. Where do you live? I mean, so this idea that our geography influences our theology is a part of this story. If you were in England, you benefited passively from the transatlantic slave trade, but by and large, you were not enslaving people directly, even though you had the same theological beliefs. If you lived in colonial America or America, there is a good chance that you would have either participated or approved of enslaving people until about maybe 1800 or so. And it mostly has to do not with your Bible or your theology, it's where you live and the practices that are going around in your community. So that part's actually pretty scary. And it's a good reason for us to listen to the global church and to listen to others, past in history, but even currently in other parts of the world as they are reading the Bible and practicing their faith.
Yeah, no, that's good. So another question I have are related to the similarities and the differences between these three figures. I'm probably most interested in the significant differences that they have. Where would you pinpoint to say this is really unique from, say, one of them compared to the others?
Mm-hmm. As it relates to this topic?
Yeah, as it relates to slavery.
Yeah, I mean, you know, briefly, I mean, Wesley's the famous Arminian, right? And so there's that. And then you have Edwards is kind of a complicated reformed person. And then Whitfield's kind of a run-of-the-mill reformed Calvinist. And so as it turns out, I don't think any of those theological foundations influence their readings on any of these passages. It kind of goes across the board and has nothing to do with any of that. So in that regard, they really aren't different at all. If they do have a commonality, it goes back that they're influenced by early Christian thinking, or early, like when I say English Christian thinking, and I spend a whole chapter talking about what were the assumptions of English, meaning from England, Christians, about the Puritans. All of them were heavily influenced by the teaching of the Puritans, especially on the household order, the way that husbands and wives, parents and children, masters and slaves, or masters and servants are should be ordered. So they, on this specific topic, there's not much difference that goes theologically. One thing that does happen later in life would be, because Wesley lived so much longer. So Wesley and Edwards were born in the same year, 1703. So that's really interesting, because they're starting in two different countries with very similar theological grandparents, even though Arminian and stuff, but like their grandparents are theologically the same people. So that's a great snapshot. Edwards dies in 58. Wesley dies in 91. So Edwards dies right before a whole bunch of interesting stuff happens with abolitionism. Whitfield dies in 1770. So he lives on a little bit longer. But theologically speaking, the interesting thing that happens for Wesley is, you know, 1770, Wesley preaches Whitfield's funeral sermon, and you see him not, though a eulogy is not the time to maybe bring up someone's weaknesses, he's never pushed back on anything about Wesley's orphanage. In fact, he's been super supportive of it. But in that era, from like 1771, 72, this is when the Quakers start getting loud. This is when the atrocities are being documented by Granville Sharp and others. This is where some just really terrible, the Zong incident is happening. This is where American, obviously, revolution is starting to go up. And there's strong, not only political questions, but theological questions about liberty. Also, Whitfield is now reconsidering his eschatology and saying, yes, we've always had a huge passion for evangelism, for evangelizing. This is of utmost importance. He starts to have a social concern and say, well, we don't need to just evangelize people. Maybe God is interested in us caring for societies. And so the American Revolution and the English, the whole revolutionary era is changing people's thoughts about liberty, about freedom, about how I think independently as a thinker, which has certainly influenced evangelicals. And so basically, Edwards didn't live as long to live into that era. Whitfield was just coming up on it. But Wesley is the guy that I think you do see some change in his theology, and I document it in the book, that because of the era he lived in, there are some changes, like his eschatology, his views on liberty, and things like that.
So if there's one area that you would say encourage people to do further reading and research on that's beyond the actual content of your book, what would it be?
Well, I mean, if someone is a biblical scholar, I think there's still a book or research to be written on clear explanations on how to navigate the Bible in that way. There's attempts. Most of them are muddied by a lack of a clear distinction between management and institution. Almost all of them. So I know I did see that. I believe Issa Macaulay has. I think it's coming out in like 2 or 3 years. I just saw on social media. So I'm very curious about his book on this topic. But yeah, if there's anyone, biblical scholar or even pastorally sermons and things like that, a clear distinction on how to read these texts. It really does require a good eye for what kind of hermeneutic that we bring that is consistent. If you're going to read it rather straightforwardly on certain slavery passages, how does your hermeneutic work on other passages, of which we should all be aware of how to change those gears as we go. But it's on this topic, it's particularly difficult, as it is for a lot of ethical questions that we've been thinking about that are significant in the last 100, 200, 300 years. So there's a biblical studies project there for sure. As far as theological, I would say there's for the doctrine of creation, doctrine of God, there's a lot of helpful work, and this is going to end up leaning toward pastoral things, about keeping a clear distinction between the creator-creation divide. I know that's like a rather obvious topic, but one of our temptations, and this is a Christological topic, would be because Jesus is incarnate, he takes on flesh, we have a particular temptation to worship humans. Well, we do worship a human. That's the thing. We worship a human, Jesus. And so there's a particular temptation for us to worship other humans. I think in part because our Savior, Jesus, took on flesh. And so a strong Chalcedonian or Christological view of Jesus, obviously human nature, how does that work then that we can create a distinction? So also, when we come into union with Christ, theosis, however you want to parse that, as we are changed, the temptation to keep that distinction. So like I had a whole chapter that I wrote on iconoclasm and about the difference that others had, John Damascus, others, about keeping that distinction. It was about icons back then, but they did really careful work on what's the difference between honoring someone and worshiping someone. And there's a real interesting project there. I ended up cutting out, maybe I'll put it somewhere else, but how do we honor this is, I believe it's Sean Damascus. I don't have the notes in front of me. I think he teaches us to honor humans when they reflect the image of God and to not honor them when they don't. But we only worship God and who always reflects who he is. So that could be an interesting project or theological investigation in the history of that. And then how iconoclasm and stuff has reemerged in Protestantism and the Reformation is also interesting.
Yeah, I mean, those all sound very interesting. And I wish I had the time to go track all that stuff down. So whoever's listening.
No, you can interview people. You can find people for this, I'm sure. Yeah, you know everyone, right. Jordan.
So I'm excited for whoever does the work to talk to them and learn from them about these things.
Yeah.
So before we end, what's the next project for you, Sean? What are you working on?
I'm taking a step back. I've produced a bunch of stuff. So I think in the last 5 years, I've published 4 books and had chapters and things and all that. And so I'm kind of taking a step back to see and ask God just, you know, what I should be working on. So I have an interesting chapter coming up here. My youngest is, my wife and I are about to be empty nesters and all that. So I'm actually doing a tiny little sabbatical this summer to kind of think about that. But I've been really thankful for everything I have been able to do, and we'll see. So, yeah.
Well, that's all, you know, that's good advice, even if you didn't mean it to be advice. Because I think a lot of people who are into these, you know, at least into the more academic conversations, they feel like they got to be constantly going. There's always going to be something they're producing. And so the reminder that that's not necessarily the case is helpful and healthy.
Yeah. Wisdom comes through time. And so I think this is one of the reasons Tim Keller's the most classic observation. He's quite old when he started publishing, but man, he had a deep well to draw from. You know, I'm 47. I have a little bit. I almost need like that sponge to get soaked back up something that might be useful for my own edification and Lord willing, maybe for others. But I think those of us I'm not that young, but, you know, I think, That's kind of the season I'm in. I'm wanting to take a step back before I feel like I have something to offer. So that's kind of what I'm doing. Like when a band comes out with their first album, you know, that's really good. You're like, that's amazing. And then there's a sophomore slump, you know, it's because they put their whole life into that first album. But if someone has been around for a long time before they say anything, I think they have a lot more to offer. And that's one of the reasons why I in particular, like really drawn towards older saints that have maybe waited a bit. You know, like when Hal Sinkfield's, Cure of Souls came out, you go, where's this guy been? And you realize that he's been doing this for decades. And just every sentence is just so rich. Or Tim Keller, other people like that. Well, I also really love the insights from, you know, everyone. But in particular, from people who take time to kind of soak it up and process it, chew on it for a long time, and then distill it down to what people need to hear. That's, I don't have a lot of that. I might be. So I'm trying to seek to figure out if I have anything to offer. We'll see.
That's great. Well, this has been awesome. So Sean, I really appreciate you taking the time. And as a reminder, go ahead and pick up the book. It's, you know, we talked to a lot of people who have the Oxford books, and those are really expensive. This is not one of those. You can actually afford it without, like, you know, going without food for a whole week. Yeah. Which, no, you know, groceries may be so expensive that maybe it's just a day now. But whatever it is, whatever the case is, this is an affordable book. So I encourage you to go get a copy of it to support guys like Sean and the work that they're doing. So we appreciate you all listening and tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor Super Drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.